loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, the intelligence services of the Five Eyes countries, the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, are quietly warning technology firms that they want access to all encrypted emails, text messages, and voice communications, and they are threatening to compel the companies to give it to them if they don't do so voluntarily. Next, legendary Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward has a new book coming out. Fear, Trump in the White House will be released on Tuesday, but leaked passages are already making the news. They portray the White House as a veritable killing field of political careers and a president who is unhinged, unpredictable, and obsessed with the Mueller investigation. That might ring true, but Woodward has a history of embellishing and, in some cases, just making things up. Then Amazon yesterday hit a market valuation of $1 trillion, only the second company in the world to reach that number besides Apple. Founder Jeff Bezos is the world's wealthiest man at $165 billion. All the while, many of his employees work for minimum wage and qualify for food stamps. And then Capitol Hill is buzzing with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Republicans laud Kavanaugh's supposed mainstream Republican views, while Democrats complain that the nomination would tilt the court further to the left, especially on social issues. But what neither side is talking about is Kavanaugh's well-documented opposition to net neutrality. And finally, Democratic insurgent Diana Presley, a Boston City Council member, defeated 10-term incumbent Mike Capuano yesterday in a hotly contested Democratic primary in Massachusetts. The upset is another indication that the Democratic Party rank and file are angry, motivated, and getting out the vote. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the intelligence services of the Five Eyes nations, that is the U.S., the U.K., Canada, Australia, and New Zealand. They are quietly warning technology firms in their countries that they want access to all encrypted emails, text messages, and voice communications. That's our emails, text messages, and voice communications. And they're threatening to compel the companies to give it to them if they don't do so voluntarily. Meanwhile, the CEOs of Facebook and Twitter are testifying on Capitol Hill today. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, good to talk to you.
Hey, John and Brian. Good to be back. I missed you on Monday, but hope you had a great Labor Day.
Thank you. Same to you. Chris, there's no surprise, I think, that we've come to this point, right? I mean, the FBI reportedly spent $1.6 million to hire hackers a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, to crack an iPhone that was allegedly used by the San Bernardino shooter. And the intelligence services of these countries have complained for years that PGP is so good and encryption on these new apps is so good that they just simply can't crack it. And so now they're threatening these companies and telling them that they need to write a backdoor into the programming so the likes of the CIA and NSA and GCHQ can read everything that we write. Is that correct? Am I reading this in the correct way?
John, you're absolutely reading this in the correct way. And in fact, if you look at the UK, Theresa May has been launching this massive campaign against encryption, calling it a national security issue. Really briefly, what encryption does is it takes your message or your image or whatever it is and encodes it in a way that only you and your recipient can see it. So when it's going over the wires or over the cellular network or whatnot, it's not readable by anyone who could intercept it. And you can store encrypted files on your computer, on your phone, all of that. It's a way to protect something so that only people with the key can open it, just like, you know, kind of like your home, right? So what these governments want to do is force the technology companies to insert a backdoor, meaning that the technology companies, that the security agencies, would have a way to get into your device, your information, whatever you've stored, to make it a lot easier. And I'm glad you brought up the situation with the FBI and Apple, because that's what a lot of this comes down to, is that it costs so much money for these agencies, even with their huge budgets, to crack this technology, right? As computers get faster, encryption gets better, and it just takes longer and longer and costs so much more money to crack it without knowing the secrets behind it. So installing a backdoor will effectively let them do it instantly.
Yeah, this is what we always fear in the transparency community, I guess we can call ourselves, is this backdoor. Because with a backdoor, there's literally no privacy. There's no such thing as privacy, that Big Brother can look at literally anything you do, anything you say, presumably without a warrant and without probable cause, that there really is this enormous intelligence service hanging over our heads, watching our every move.
That's right. They will do that. They will be watching. Often they have to go to third-party companies to get the data afterwards, right? Like, they have to ask Facebook or Apple or Google to let them into the software or to crack the device. And we do know that Apple had said no at that point. But, you know, we have to wonder, under enough pressure, what will these companies do when they're told to insert these backdoors into their products? And these backdoors have been in other products before. There was one in an old version of Windows that the NSA effectively had put in there. And there are a number of other instances where products have had these backdoors to one extent or another.
Tell us a little bit about why the CEOs of Facebook and Twitter are testifying on Capitol Hill. Is this about privacy?
Well, on its face, some of the senators made it seem like it was about privacy, but effectively this was just part of the anti-Russia, anti-China, anti-Iran campaign. Dorsey and Sandberg of Twitter and Facebook, respectively, were on Capitol Hill today in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee for their fourth appearance in a series on social media. Interestingly enough, Google did not show up, and they had said a few days ago they were not going to show up. Now, some senators, Ron Wyden, who we talked about in the past, and a few others, did ask about privacy and security. But, you know, I'm really more interested in the questions that somebody like Marco Rubio and Tom Cotton asked, calling for partnerships with Facebook and Twitter against what he said were adversaries in China, the DPRK, Iran, Russia, and so on. Really, the interesting thing about that is that Facebook and Twitter are already clear partners in the U.S. government's struggle against those countries that it has a very hostile relationship with. One of the other things in his closing, Chairman Burr of this committee actually asked the committee to consider removing antitrust regulations in the name of cooperation and national security. That just opens the door for so many other issues in terms of data privacy and our privacy as users of these services. And I want to follow up and see, where is that going to go? Because it was just a kind of an off-the-cuff mention at the end. So like I said, some people did ask about privacy, and I think those are important questions, and the public needs to be aware of that. But really, these hearings, especially today's hearing, was just a way to condemn the Russian, Chinese, Iranian governments because the U.S. government is waging these wars, these literal wars, but also these information wars against them.
And I'll tell you what really frightens me is, if Congress is successful in passing legislation that would force technology companies to create this backdoor for our own intelligence services, how long is it going to be before the Russians, the Chinese, the North Koreans, or any number of other countries, the Israelis, are able to crack into that back door and they are able to steal our data and our private information? Doesn't it make more sense to have no back door, and then if law enforcement needs the information, they do what they've always done in the past? They go to court and they get a court order or a warrant, and then they go to the technology company with a warrant and say, please give us the information.
First, with these online services like Facebook and Twitter, they already have a backdoor. It's the NSA's PRISM program. They've installed themselves and have a complete cooperation. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because a backdoor is effectively a security vulnerability. And it doesn't stay secret for long. We saw this with the CIA Vault 7 leak last year, right? So anytime there is a way to get into a system to expose the data on it, somebody will find that, whether it's a rogue NSA employee or security researchers or, you know, bad actors from somewhere else, not even government related, just, you know, a group of hackers. They will find that vulnerability and they will exploit it. And these vulnerabilities go for a lot of money, you know, on the underground economies. And so we need to be very concerned about these back doors. But again, Twitter and Facebook, they already have installed one, and it's right there for the NSA to use.
I have to say that with these developments over the last couple of years, I'm not seeing anything to celebrate in the way of transparency or privacy. Is there any legislation, Chris? Is there any leadership on Capitol Hill that we can look forward to? Is there anybody who's out there trying to protect our interests? We have about 2 minutes left.
Not in any sort of effective way. Again, some of the senators, you know, did bring up questions about privacy, but I think those were very much for show. Ron Wyden and a couple others, they may care about privacy for sure. But I think that just was not the purpose of this hearing. The purpose of this hearing was really to be about this anti-Russia, anti-China, anti-Iran campaign. And in fact, there were some questions today about repealing U.S. Code 230, which protects online service providers from prosecution for the contents that their users post. And that would be a serious First Amendment issue, and I think a violation of the First Amendment, and have chilling effects. And we've already seen that with the passing of SESTA and FOSTA that forced, you know, Craigslist personal ads to shut down and many other sites.
Yeah. Okay, one last question. I want to talk real quickly about the app Viber. Viber is very similar to Signal or to WhatsApp. It's encrypted, but it's European-based. It's not a U.S. app. Would it make sense for users who are serious about their privacy to begin transitioning away from some of these U.S. or Five Eyes-based apps to something like Viber?
You know, it could make sense, depending on your situation. I still trust Signal the most because it is proven cryptographically proven encryption technology, and also tested in the courts, where Signal literally has no information about what is being sent. Signal has been subpoenaed by the FBI for all information about a certain user, and what they provided was, yes, this person signed up for an account on this day, and that is literally all the information. They complied fully, and that was all the information they had. So, you know, I think where the service is hosted does have something to do with it, but I do think that the encryption used and what metadata, the information about what you're sending is stored, is actually even more important. So I would recommend people continue to use Signal.
You heard it from an expert. I use Signal literally every single day. Well, that was Chris Graffa. He joined us from New Haven, Connecticut. Chris is a web developer and technologist, and he's with us also every Monday talking about technology and technological developments. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Legendary Washington Post reporter Bob Woodward has a new book coming out, Fear, Trump in the White House, will be released on Tuesday. But leaked passages are already making the news. They portray the White House as a veritable killing field of political careers and a president who is unhinged, unpredictable, and obsessed with the Mueller investigation. That rings true, but Woodward has a history of embellishing and, in some cases, just making things up. We're joined from California by Joe Loria. Joe is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Joe, welcome back.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Joe, everybody loves these salacious stories that may or may not be true. They're funny, they're fun, especially if you don't like Donald Trump. They're very entertaining, and it seems like every couple of years, Bob Woodward comes out with a book just like this, whether it's about George W. Bush or Barack Obama or Donald Trump. But we know from previous incidents, beginning with his book Veil, the story of the CIA under Bill Casey, that he either embellishes or makes some things up. So what do you think we should make out of this book?
Well, obviously, we're going to have to read it if we really want to make a totally informed comment. But based on what we know now, I would say the onus is on Woodward, of course, to prove his assertions. The CNN about the book wrote that the onus is on Trump to prove Woodward made major mistakes. This reminds me of people's reactions to the Mueller indictments, particularly the one of the GRU agents. People saying, "Well, you got to prove that he's wrong." No. An indictment is an assertion that has to be proven to be correct. So the onus is on Woodward. First of all, the worst thing Trump could have done here was to respond at all to this book. So Woodward and his publishers knew he would, and they're starting to count the money right now. So he's jacking up the sales, totally hurting his own case. Woodward is really the essence of an establishment reporter. In the books on Obama and Bush that he wrote, he had the cooperation of the administrations who were trying to shape the story that he told. Trump did not do this, and that was probably a mistake, as well as reacting to the book. He should have cooperated and made all people available on the record to Woodward. That would have diffused his whole way of writing this book, which is to depend really on secondhand information. People say that Mattis said, people say that McMaster said. This is secondhand gossip. What he's written is a gossipy book, which of course is going to sell extremely well. People want to read that stuff. When a reporter is shut out from his sources, he's going to be more eager to go after that person. So he had to rely on named sources for the most part. And I'm not saying Woodward is making things up. Of course, we haven't read the book yet. But the issue is whether the people he talked to are exaggerating or even making stuff up. And you have to question, why are they still working in the White House if they hate this guy so much, if they hate Trump so much? Why? Now, there are former people, of course, who quit that talked to him, some of them on the record. And the issue here is whether we learn what is going on in terms of who is controlling or managing Trump. Trump announces, for example, in Ohio last April that we're pulling our troops, our special forces out of Syria. They're still there. Why are they still there? Why does he continuously make statements that he's going to do something, particularly on foreign policy, and then they don't happen? The opposite happens. So we would like to know, I would like to know from this book, if it has any insights into who is controlling or manipulating or managing Trump, who's making the actual decisions on policy, both foreign and domestic. And we do have one clue from the book. Apparently, Gary Cohen, who was a chief economic advisor of Trump, who's resigned, who spoke on the record. So this is what we want, on the record comments. He says that he took from Trump's desk in the Oval Office a draft letter that was written that would have withdrawn the U.S. from a free trade agreement with South Korea. So he took it off his desk, and he's quoted in the book as saying, "I stole it off his desk." Oh, Cohen told an associate, "I'm sorry, I was wrong." He told an associate. So he doesn't get it directly from Cohen. Again, another second-hand thing. But he said he stole it off his desk. I wouldn't let him see it. He's never going to see that document. Got to protect the country. That gives you an insight, if this is true, that there are people around Trump who are running the White House, running the administration, making policy decisions, cutting the president out of his decision-making, which, yes, we think that's why he's there, to make decisions. But people around him are clearly making decisions for him or manipulating him. And we want to, if the book has insight to that, it'll be valuable.
Joe Luria is our guest. Joe is the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, a longtime journalist. We're talking about Bob Woodward's book. One thing that always struck me about Woodward's reporting, John, you know, like when he wrote the book Veil,
right?
He made it sound like William Casey, who was this kind of right-wing CIA director, sort of a cowboy type figure, you know, that he was dying and he went and got his, you know, deathbed confession.
Yeah, he confessed to Bob Woodward of all people.
Yeah. And, you know, there are a lot of people thought, well, did he really? Was William Casey actually whispering into Woodward's ear?
After having had a stroke and being deemed a vegetable?
Yeah. Anyway, the other thing is, back in the day when he became famous with Carl Bernstein and writing All the President's Men, The President's Men About Watergate, the real reason he got that story was Mark Felt, who was the number two in the FBI under J. Edgar Hoover, was the one who was, he was deep throat. He was the one sort of taking those reporters down that trail, exposing all of Nixon's criminal conduct.
And remember, they had met in a dentist's office. That's where they first were introduced to one another. They were waiting to see the same dentist. And Mark Felt thought, well, here's this young go-getter at the Washington Post. We should exchange cards.
So Woodward was actually sort of used by Felt, number two at the FBI, to bring down Nixon. Now, we know that the intelligence agencies were clearly unsettled by the idea of somebody like Donald Trump becoming president of the United States. When you look at a Comey's investigation or Peter Stroke or Andrew McCabe or Bruce Orr, the Justice Department and these career professionals really obviously thought Donald Trump was not the right man for being the CEO of the United States. Again, do you think Bob Woodward is sort of being used by forces in intelligence communities, as obviously Mark Felt was using him to bring down Nixon? What do you think?
That's the name of the game in Washington, isn't it? They're both using each other. Woodward's using these people to help continue to build his career and his bank account and his fame and what he thinks is a big scoop. And he's being used for this purpose, to bring down Trump, by the people that he spoke with. And that's exactly, of course, what happened during Watergate, as you said. There are some people who even believe that the CIA had an involvement, that Woodward was somehow an asset of them, and that this was a coup against Nixon. I'm not saying I'm going there. But certainly, reporters being used by powerful people in Washington happens every single day. That's basically what we're reading in our daily newspapers and the corporate media, what the most powerful people want American people to know. And they tell these things to reporters, often unnamed, and reporters go unchallenged and repeat what they're being told. So Woodward, and that helps the reporter's career. And this is the game that's being played, and the public is who suffers here. So that is Woodward, as I said at the beginning, is a quintessential establishment reporter who has played that game perhaps better than anybody in Washington.
And using almost anonymous sources, in the Obama book, it's just a little, this is tangential, but kind of funny. He criticized Obama in his book about the Obama administration, and the Obama team sort of hit back at Woodward. And here's Donald Trump tweeting, "Only the Obama White House can get away with attacking Bob Woodward," Trump wrote in March 2013, amid a running dispute between the longtime reporter and Barack Obama's staff over Woodward's criticism of the president's messaging on budget cuts. Only Obama could attack the great Bob Woodward. It's kind of a secondary piece, but it shows the narcissism, of course, of Trump. If Woodward had written something flattering about Donald Trump, he would right now say Bob Woodward is the greatest guy in the world, but now he's the worst guy in the world. Again, what I think is important here is that all of these stories, in a way, become sort of a form of recreation and titillation and book selling, and where the public is reduced to being the spectator, Joe, instead of the participant. And all the people who don't like Trump, and I'm certainly amongst them, but you know, so many of the liberal and progressive type people are sitting around as spectators watching all of these salacious details come out from, like, Jim Mattis, or who should be considered no friend of anybody progressive. I mean, or Gary Cohn from Goldman Sachs. It kind of reduces everything to a spectacle, and it's actually not the way people should be struggling against the really bad policies of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I totally agree. You're absolutely right the way you described it. It is a spectacle. It's a circus. And it shouldn't necessarily be taken as serious reporting unless we have insights, as I mentioned, into who is managing Trump, particularly on foreign affairs. If there's anything that's solid in there about that, the book could have value. Otherwise, it's just gossip, and it's secondhand, and it's being denied. Mattis denied he said the things that somebody said he said. And I remember seeing once Woodward on Larry King, I think, and he's said, you know, you need two sources for everything. Even if there's a traffic accident on the corner, you need to have two, and you've witnessed it, you need two sources. So, I mean, is he following that own, his own ridiculous standards right there, that you need two sources? So, you know, it looks like he doesn't even have one on the record, and most of this is all hearsay. And I'm not sure I'm going to read the book. I don't think I read one of his previous books. I can't even remember because it's in there. And if anything really solid is in there, we'll read about it in the press. So I don't recommend going out necessarily paying for this book.
Yeah, I agree with you. And doing this kind of public relations rollout with all the salacious details from the beginning of yesterday morning till the afternoon, the book kept climbing, climbing, climbing. By the end of the afternoon yesterday, number one on Amazon's bestseller list, which for Bob Woodward and the publisher, that's what it's really about. For people who actually care about policy and politics, better not to just get on that gravy train, helping people get rich, doing these kind of, you know, basically, I think, essentially publicity stunts.
That's what it is. We're going to have to leave it there, though. We were joined from Santa Monica, California by Joe Luria. Joe's the editor-in-chief of Consortium News, founded by the late Robert Perry, and he's the author of the book How I Lost by Hillary Clinton. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Amazon yesterday hit a market valuation of $1 trillion, only the second company in the world to reach that number besides Apple. Founder Jeff Bezos is the world's wealthiest man at $165 billion. All the while, many of his employees work for minimum wage and qualify for food stamps. We're joined from California by Dr. Jack Rasmus, a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. You can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. Jack, welcome back.
My pleasure.
The easy question first, Jack. How is it that people who work for Amazon are not in the streets over the notion that Jeff Bezos is the richest man in the world with $165 billion, and they can barely make ends meet. They're not allowed to take a break to use the restroom. They're not allowed to have a union. They're not allowed to take a lunch break. How do they square this?
And why now $1 trillion? I mean, this is kind of the epic of monopoly capitalism to the 10th degree here.
Well, you got to have an organization that will lead them into the street. People as individuals, isolated, fragmented, don't feel that just by going in the street themselves, they can achieve very much. And that's the problem. You know, we don't have organizations that are willing to take these people into the street and protest in all kinds of ways. You know, the unions have been decimated. They're barely hanging on. So they're not taking the lead, although there is some evidence of some unions, you know, fighting for a $15 minimum wage and so forth. But, you know, it's not very well organized, and there's no real strategy. So, you know, working folks aren't stupid. They're not going to just run off into the street. We've come off of a terrible recession that still hasn't recovered for most Americans. You know, we've got lies about wages rising, which they're not. So people are desperate. They're just holding on to what they can and looking for some kind of organizational leadership to take them into the streets. It's not that they don't want to go. It's that, you know, they're not going to just jump off by themselves.
But Jack, why do unions have such difficulty breaking into these big companies like Amazon and Walmart and Target and places like that?
Well, because we've built up over 4 or 5 decades this immense anti-union structure here, both in the legal system and in these law firms and state laws and restrictions on striking and restrictions on organizing and so forth. They've made it very difficult. Labor is the Gulliver that has been pinned down by this web of legal and political institutional restrictions. It's been corralled. It's been tamed. You know, that explains a lot why they're not stepping out that much.
The Teamsters represent the workers at Costco. Costco has 16,000 workers. I believe this will be the next battlefield for labor. But I want to change the subject, if we might, to going back to the issue of the $1 trillion valuation. I mean, it's a staggering number. It's beyond really the scope of almost anyone's imagination. Again, what does it have any, besides just having an extra zero, an extra digit in there, an extra decimal point, does it represent anything significant? It's when you look at the stock market, it's just these few big companies that are swallowing up most of the big gains on the stock market. What does it say about Amazon, and what does it say about where we are in the current this current stage of corporate capitalism?
Well, you know, you got this huge stock market run up led by the techs, you know, which Amazon's one of them. And it's driven by the fact that you've got over $1 trillion every year for the last 7 years of corporate buybacks of stock and dividend payouts. And in fact, this year is going to be about $1.3 trillion because of the Trump tax cuts. You see, that's feeding into it as well. And the mergers and acquisitions, you know, all this huge shift of income to the wealthiest 1% in the investors is flowing into financial asset markets. And that's what's keeping this up. As long as you keep giving them tax cuts and everything, it's going to keep flowing and driving up the stock market. And of course, you know, the business model that Amazon has is very attractive. It's gobbling up all of the smaller retail across the country. That's where the investors, flush with trillions of dollars of cash, are putting their money.
That's the problem of capitalism, isn't it?
Well, yeah. I've written about the fact that we've had for a couple of decades now this relative shift towards financial asset markets investing. And that's why we don't see so much investing going on in real assets that create real jobs and so forth. There's this, you know, because it's much more profitable to invest in financial markets that keep rising. And that's a problem with 21st century capitalism.
You know, Jeff Bezos earlier this year, as a consequence of this surge, this capital that's being drawn in from all over the world into the U.S. stock market, there's a strong dollar. The U.S. government, through quantitative easing, has given the banks in particular, but the biggest corporations, just free money. So all this money is being drawn into the stock market, and a lot of it is going to the big players like Amazon. Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, who also owns the Washington Post, who also has a owner of the Whole Foods, also has a $600 million contract with the CIA. I'm looking at an article from January 24th of this year. Bezos made nearly $3 billion in one day due to the belief that Amazon stocks were going to rise, so money flowed in. $3 billion. That's 3,000 millions in one day. I mean, have we ever been in at this kind of thing in human history? I mean, it's amazing. $3 billion in one day?
Well, it's mostly because of the appreciation of the value of the stock price. You know, when they say he's made $3 billion, that means his stock price has gone up. So he owns all that stock, and therefore he's earned, quote, earned, not really earned, all that money. But that's a reflection of this incredible run-up in stock prices, you know, doubling and tripling ever since the 2008-09 crash, while wages, real wages, just for inflation, have continued to go down even this year. Contrary to all the spin and hype about rising wages, it's not true. So, you know, all the money is going to the Bezoses and the wealthiest 1% and the investors. They've recovered quickly and nicely, and they're, you know, shoveling $1 trillion a year into their pockets, while the rest of the folks are struggling with stagnant or declining real wages.
Yeah, Business Insider, John, did a thing about Bezos, the CEO of Amazon. His worth, so-called worth, is increasing at roughly $231,000 per minute.
Per minute.
In 2018. So in a minute, he makes, that's about four times what the average American makes in a year. Four times what the average American makes. And Jack, I was looking at other statistics. The bottom 90% of America's income earners, those families, their average income, family income, the bottom 90%, is $30,047 per year. Jeff Bezos is increasing his wealth at $231,000 per minute in 2018.
And that's where I get stuck on this issue. I understand there's this natural desire in a capitalist society to want to get rich and you have nice things. But there is such a thing as too much money. And Jeff Bezos, in my view, has too much money. You can't spend $165 billion if you try for the rest of your life to spend $165 billion. So why is it that Jeff Bezos's employees are among the worst paid and the worst treated in the industry?
Yeah.
The money's there.
Yeah, Jack, it's kind of like low-income workers are low-income and poor people are poor. Because rich people like Jeff Bezos have all the money. I mean, that's a vulgarization. But in essence, that money comes from somewhere. It's from the profit of the corporations. It could be going to workers or it could be going to society to help other low-income people. But it's actually just accrues to him.
Well, you know, the phenomenon that people don't understand is that corporations don't, like Bezos's Amazon and others, don't give wage increases unless there's a reason pushing them to give wage increases. You know, public protests like the teachers recently, you know, or the minimum wage $15 an hour movement in the streets, or unions. And the unions, of course, have been debilitated, and they don't play the role that they used to play of coming out of a recession, recovering some of the wages. That's a big factor. The destruction of the unions means you've removed an institutional force to recover some of the wage loss from recessions. And, of course, the last one was very severe. And that's why your wage earners have stagnated, the bottom 90%. You know, they've gone nowhere or backwards, while the shift to financial asset markets means all the wealth is flowing into financial assets and price appreciation of financial assets. And that's why you've got guys like Bezos and others getting incredibly rich off of the financial asset markets.
Yeah, 231,000 richer every minute. John, before we leave, I want to tell our audience that Jack Rasmus, our guest, has a new article out. You can get it on ZNet. The title is very important because it represents part of what we were talking about today. It's Labor Day 2018, The Myth of Rising Wages by Jack Rasmus on ZNet.
Excellent.
Also my blog, jackrasmus.com.
Okay, jackrasmus.com. Thank you.
That was the voice of Jack Rasmus. He joined us from California. He's a professor of economics at St. Mary's College of California and author of Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy and the Coming Depression. And again, you can check out his work at www.jackrasmus.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Capitol Hill is buzzing with the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. Republicans laud Kavanaugh's supposed mainstream Republican views, while Democrats complain that the nomination would tilt the court farther to the right, especially on social issues. But what neither side is talking about, at least today, is Kavanaugh's well-documented opposition to net neutrality. We'll talk about that with Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, and he joins us from Washington. Tim, welcome back.
Hi, how are you guys?
Very well, thank you. Thanks for joining us. So nobody's talking about Kavanaugh's opposition to net neutrality, and it's actually very well documented. I was fascinated to read that his position is this, and I'm reading this from an article in Motherboard. It says, net neutrality mandates that telecommunications network operators must treat all web traffic as neutral. In other words, ISPs are prevented from throttling or blocking service to certain websites, and they are not allowed to charge a premium for any type of access. But he argues that net neutrality rules violate the free speech of the companies. What do you make of that?
Well, it's an argument that we've heard before. The lawyers who work for the ISPs, companies like Comcast and Verizon and AT&T, have made the First Amendment argument, which is to say that your ISP, the company that sells you internet access, is much like a newspaper, whereby the editors of that newspaper get to pick and choose what stories appear on page one, what commentary goes on their opinion pages. The ISPs themselves also have the same right in that they get to edit the internet in favor of the content that they would like to see. And it's an argument that has been debunked by many First Amendment scholars, many of whom wrote letters to the FCC explaining how this has no validity. But we do have in Judge Kavanaugh a track record. He served on the U.S. Federal Appeals Court for the First District, and he heard a case. It was an effort by the phone and cable lobby to reverse the 2015 net neutrality rules, which were passed by the Obama FCC. Net neutrality supporters won that case, but he did offer a dissenting opinion, which said exactly that the First Amendment grants them the right to violate net neutrality.
So this is not up for grabs. It's not a question. We know because this is the case, the United States Telecom Association versus FCC, the 2015 ruling in which Brett Kavanaugh wrote a minority dissent. And in it, just as Tim is saying, he argued that net neutrality mandates that the telecommunications networks operators must treat all web traffic as neutral, meaning they don't pick and choose. And that's what made Brett Kavanaugh mad. So in the name of the rights of telecom providers who are in this to make money, and deter or subvert, obstruct, prohibit, make impossible our exercise of our free speech rights, their rights, Tim, are primary. Their rights are premium. Our rights actually thus are extinguished under Brett Kavanaugh's logic.
Yeah, it's very Orwellian in many ways. It just basically gives these very large companies power to censor and constitutional precedents, according to Kavanaugh, that allows them to do that is the First Amendment. And most Americans understand that the First Amendment protects free speech for individuals being people like you and me and not corporations. His interpretation matches in a lot of ways the interpretation of the Supreme Court in the Citizens United ruling, which has basically said that very large companies that were funding super PACs have a First Amendment right that needs to be protected, which would allow them to funnel. It basically said that money was speech, allowed them to funnel large amounts of money to the political process. So there's a similarity there. There's a history that links Judge Kavanaugh's thinking on net neutrality with the thinking that went behind the Citizens United decision that allowed very wealthy corporations and individuals to funnel all sorts of money into the political process.
Tim, let me ask you a question. Let's say that Kavanaugh is confirmed, and it looks like while it'll be close, he probably will be confirmed. So what happens then? What kind of issues, cases, would he be expected to see on the Supreme Court related to net neutrality?
Well, there are a number of cases that are wending their way through the courts right now. My organization, Free Press, is suing the Trump FCC, the FCC under Chairman Ajit Pai, for its 2017 decision, which repealed the net neutrality ruling. So there's a chance that process could end up in the Supreme Court. That there is also the decision that we won related to the 2015 ruling. There's a chance that an appeal would then go to a Supreme Court that under Kavanaugh, if he is indeed approved by the Senate, would be much more favorable towards the ISP's interpretation. And so, you know, there, it's likely that this will go before him. This has been a very contentious issue. It has gone before judges in many appeals courts over the years. There's a history of rulings on this issue that could wind up in the Supreme Court. And whereas before we were reasonably confident that we would win an argument in the Supreme Court, as we have won in the lower courts consistently in support of net neutrality, with Brett Kavanaugh as a justice, it is less certain.
How big of an issue was this for Donald Trump in selecting Kavanaugh as the nominee? I mean, for we the people, the impact will be so vast. I mean, here you have Ajit Pai, former general counsel for Verizon, I think, who's now functioning as chairperson of the FCC, rolling back, repealing net neutrality. Now, if these cases come before the court, obviously, under this current constellation, if Kavanaugh is in fact the one of the nine justices, they will rule on behalf of the big corporations and against the people. There's a lot of money at stake, a lot for us, the people, at stake. Was it a factor, do you think, in Trump's own calculations?
Well, I mean, I think it's part of a larger profile. His opinion on net neutrality is part of a larger profile of a potential Supreme Court justice who is consistently favorable towards deregulation on the one hand, but really corporations, to very pro-corporate agenda. And so net neutrality was a piece of that larger puzzle. Now, I don't think, you know, Trump's decision to nominate Kavanaugh swung on the net neutrality issue. I think probably, knowing Trump as much as I think we do, as anyone could, he was more interested in Kavanaugh's positions about indicting a sitting president and things like that. But I'm certain that as much as Washington is still controlled by the swamp, and my interpretation of the swamp is really special corporate interests that run the influence economy in Washington, D.C., you know, Brett Kavanaugh is they're very happy about that. And the swamp is still very influential, and they're very influential not only on K Street and in Congress, but also in the White House.
Tim Carr, tell us a little bit about the cases that you've been following. You've had success at the federal district and federal circuit court levels. How far along are you in the process in getting before the Supreme Court?
Well, we're happy with the appeals court decision that defended the net neutrality rules. We're in the process of another legal proceeding related to the 2017 repeal of those rules. And so we are challenging the FCC on a number of grounds, procedural, legal, a whole spate of issues, because we felt that when Chairman Pai decided to repeal the net neutrality rules, there were all sorts of improprieties. He didn't pay attention, for example, to the public docket, where tens of millions of people made comments. He was very dismissive of public opinion. He was very dismissive of legal procedure and coming to that decision. So we're suing the FCC on those grounds. And that is in process right now. We recently filed a brief. You know, we hope to have, well, there will be oral arguments by the end of this year. And we'll see how that goes forward. Now, could that end up in the Supreme Court? Certainly. You know, anything that's involved in this process has the potential to go before those justices. But at the moment, it's a little too early to tell.
That's the voice of Tim Carr. He's the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. 1 minute left, Tim. One, I see that there's a letter from your organization and Free Press and also 23 other organizations about Brett Kavanaugh. What can people do to get involved on this issue? How can they join with your organization or support it? And also, what do you expect in our last minute from the Democrats? Will they make this a big issue?
Well, I have it on pretty good intelligence that some of the Democrats who are involved in the proceeding plan to bring this up as part of, you know, of their overall dissent against Kavanaugh as Supreme Court Justice. But if you want to learn more about that, you can go to freepress.net. We're also working on several fronts to make sure that net neutrality protections are restored.
Okay, we'll leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Tim Carr. Tim is the Senior Director of Strategy and Communications at Free Press, and he joined us from Washington. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Democratic insurgent Ayanna Pressley, a Boston City Council member, defeated 10-term incumbent Mike Capuano yesterday in a hotly contested Democratic primary in Massachusetts. The upset is another indication that the Democratic Party rank and file are angry, motivated, and getting out the vote. We're joined from Atlanta by Anoa Changa. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army, and she's the host of the show The Way with Anoa. Welcome back, Anoa. Anoa, what's really interesting to me about this race is Ayanna Pressley is not a nobody. She's a somebody up there in Boston. She's a city council member. She's highly respected. And even though Mike Capuano is generally viewed as progressive, he's establishment progressive, and she's not. What do you make of this race?
Even though there are those who will say disregard this win as, oh, people just voted based on demographics, I think what we're seeing is people are getting excited about the possibility for representatives who are actually representative of the district, not just simply in you know politically, but people who are actually getting out there and engaging with people. But yes, it's great that Ayanna Pressley is a Black woman, but she's also a Black woman who's, you know, engaging the community, really getting people excited about issues. Like you all mentioned, she already has a rapport based on her role in the Boston City Council. I mean, we just saw, you know, the similar excitement elect Rachel Rollins, who was running for Suffolk County DA, which is the same general area. And you see these people who are like right on the issues that are mattering. And it's not that Mark Capuano was not, you know, was bad or wrong. And that's where the analysis gets really weird for some folks here. It's the fact that people want, one, new energy and excitement, right, in these roles. And then two, we want people who are actually like building and engaging a community, not just folks who kind of have already been there saying, well, this is just what it is. This is who the person is. I think that people are reacting to that and looking for other alternatives and fresh blood and new ideas. This isn't anything negative on him. This is a positive in terms of direction and engagement that people are seeing. When we were looking at some of just the trends, there was some, you know, uptick in voter turnout in some areas last month, some precincts yesterday. And that's a real sign that people are looking, they finally feel like they have something again that was worth voting for. Not saying it's going to be cakewalk for her now, because, you know, now once you go in, there could be some young, you know, whippersnapper ready to boot you out. So it keeps the process honest and focused and really like organizing and turned on the people and what they're looking for and wanting to see. And that's what we continue to see in all of these races. I mean, it's not the same stark contrast as we saw with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Joe Crowley in New York. But there definitely is that difference enough there that people are saying, wow, I have an option for one. And then two, I have someone who has fresh ideas and a new approach to how this should be done. And that's resonating with folks.
And, you know, one of the things that I was impressed with about this race is that unlike the New York race, the Cortez-Crowley race, which went completely negative, the Capuano-Presley race did not go negative. This was an election that was focused on ideas. And here you have two Democrats who view the Democratic Party in different ways. They offer different solutions to the problems that the party and the country face, and the voters got to choose. I mean, that's sort of the perfect political world, at least in a Democratic primary. There's no negativity. You're not trying to kill each other in the primary, and you're talking about the issues. Do you think that that's unusual, or do you think we'll see that elsewhere?
I mean, I think we'll see that where there are those people who make that a priority. And I think giving that district, given the support that Capuano received, I don't think he was able to go, quote unquote, negative. I think Ayanna Pressley, being the person that she is, ran the campaign that she ran based on showing that even though people would say why is she running against him, they're like, he's a progressive, they're the same. There are like a lot of articles, like they're pretty much the same on everything. I mean, the same thing applied here with some of the progressive folks who supported him. And she was just like, no, we should have meaningful opportunities to have other voices and other leadership in this realm. And she also brings this wealth of experience and understanding. Now, that doesn't mean that there isn't anywhere to critique or push back on either one of them in any respect, but the way they did it, I think, really set a tone and tenor for the way in which we should be engaging in politics, you know, down the line. I think that where this is prioritized and in terms of the relationships that people have in community and with other organizations, I think that also really sets the tone. So I could tell that both of them really cared about those who were supporting them, the different organizations, the entities they were vying for support from. I think that really set the tone for this race. And I think he also had to be very conscientious of not seeming like he was trying to attack, belittle, or demean a very strong, you know, woman of color who's also progressive and has been a strong leader in her own right. So I think there were a lot of conversations probably, or there was a real conscientious effort to make sure all those things were taken care of and considered in the way they both ran that race.
Anoa Changa is our guest. We're talking about the election results in Massachusetts yesterday. You know, Anoa, I went to Boston in 1974 during the middle of what was then called the busing crisis, where there were white racist, white fascist mobs. I went there to help organize what turned out to be a mass march against racism, which helped bring people from the black and white and Latino communities together to repudiate these fascist mobilizations. But what struck me about Boston, in spite of its liberal tradition, was how few black people were anywhere in elected office. William Owen, who was then this first black state legislator, this is 1974, was an ally in that mass march against racism that took place in December 1974. 25,000 people came out. It was really an important turning point. But I'm looking at a website for the station WBUR, and the headline is, Massachusetts is diverse, but our elected officials are not. And I want to read a couple sentences real quick. In the 230 years history of our Commonwealth, a woman of color has never represented Massachusetts in Congress. It's certainly a sad piece of trivia to close out Women's History Month. Massachusetts has 6 statewide elected officials, and all are white. Of our 11-member congressional delegation, all are white and 8 are men. It's clear that Massachusetts has a proverbial and very real old boys network. I mean, it's really noteworthy in Boston and in Massachusetts. And as you said, it's not simply about demographics. It's also about the kind of leadership, and it's about people reaching out and organizing and building. But the issue of the disenfranchisement or the lack of representation of especially black Americans in Massachusetts, it's an important part of this story.
Oh, absolutely agree. I mean, and we think about, you know, Boston, it's the North, Massachusetts, the Northeast, it's liberal as this. But there is a history. I mean, when we look at New York State, right, we look at New York State and it has some of the worst voter registration laws in the country. I mean, there is still this, there's this hidden history of you know, segregation, oppression, voter suppression. When we look at like more northern areas, look at Wisconsin, right? Like, so I think that we kind of get caught up in the veneer of these labels, liberal and conservative, and don't really dig in and think about the way in which power is operating and constructed to keep particular individuals, entities, and ideas and mindsets in power. And in many instances, that does fall, I mean, certainly along economic lines, but in many cases, also runs around racial and ethnic lines as well. And you can see a place that is extremely diverse, but that, you know, has not had anyone in certain positions. I mean, even still continue to look at the U.S. Senate and how white and predominantly male the Senate remains because of the barriers that exist to even be able to run. And it'll be really interesting to see what happens with the senatorial race coming out of Delaware this week on Thursday, tomorrow, actually to see if that trend can, if we can finally push through that as well. So we're in a very interesting time, and it's going to be really great to follow up and continue to watch what happens as we move through midterms and beyond to see if we can sustain this energy and the way challenging and continuing to grapple with as an electoral space, as a movement space, what does it mean to address issues of representation and intersectionality? I know some folks are tired of these words, but how do we address that in terms of also addressing the political, social, economic goals that we also need to be uplifting all our communities as well? So that's just my parting thought on that.
Yeah, that's a Noah Changa. I'm looking back at this WBUR article. And again, after the article goes through the terrible underrepresentation of women and especially people of color and especially Black people in Massachusetts, the article goes on, and I think this is so true, not just in Massachusetts, it's so true about everything. It says, more troubling for women of color is that the rank and file often work twice as hard for half as much. And when it comes to promotions, they are often passed over for the more well-connected white male candidate. I mean, that's the story, not just in the Democratic Party, it's the story in all kinds of organizations throughout America where this connection of people, of patriarchy and of racism combining to shut women out and shut people of color out, and especially shutting out women of color.
Two decades into the 21st century, even. Well, we're going to leave it there. We were joined from Atlanta by Noah Changa. She's the director of political advocacy and a managing editor of Progressive Army, and she's the host of the show The Way with Noah. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, at iHeartRadio, and at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and clear.